See, this is a coalition that's been working on. Yeah.
There it is.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome this beautiful December 8th morning. This is the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. We have a full agenda, and I certainly would like to start out. Welcome, Senator Knope and Senator Cruz, and I know that Steiner Hayter will be here shortly. We want to start with the informational meeting on Cover Oregon, and with that, I'd like to call Mr. Patnoid up. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me again. So for purpose of the record, my name is Aaron Patnoid. I'm Executive Director of Cover Oregon, Oregon's Health Insurance Marketplace. Happy to be here again. So today, I'm planning on covering a couple topics with you. I'm going to go relatively quickly, so I apologize for that in advance. But the topics primarily will focus on returns from the open enrollment periods, both this year, what we know so far, and last year. And also an update on the advanced premium tax credit issue, which we brought to your attention during the last meeting. So we are in open enrollment right now for 2015. The open enrollment period does go through February 15th. However, there are some key dates that we really have been working with consumers to really ensure folks are aware of so that we can get the most out of this ongoing open enrollment period. First and foremost, open enrollment began on November 15th. December 15th represents the last day that consumers have, that Oregonians have here in the state to enroll in coverage that will become effective starting January 1st. December 31st is the last day of 2014 coverage, and then February 15th, obviously, is the last day of the open enrollment period. So it is a shorter open enrollment period than last year, which is one of the messages that we've really been using with consumers as we go through this open enrollment period. We are using healthcare.gov this year as the website that Oregonians go to purchase insurance plans. This is just a screenshot of it. So all of our messaging related to the open enrollment period has been driving Oregonians to healthcare.gov. And the goals for the open enrollment period are to ensure that Oregonians can apply, shop, and choose a commercial plan or apply for Medicaid using healthcare.gov. Make sure we have a smooth transition to healthcare.gov to make the process easy for Oregonians so they can sit down, shop, and enroll in one seating. Connect consumers to resources and in-person assistance here in the state, so basically local help. Provide support and training to community partners and agents who are responsible for helping Oregonians go through the process of applying and enrolling. And then also to ensure that Oregon continues to have a competitive individual and small group marketplace. So how's it going so far for this open enrollment period? So obviously we're 3 weeks into it. The numbers that you see here represent information that we've received from carriers via the Oregon Insurance Division from November 15th through the 30th, so basically the first 2 weeks of the open enrollment period. So what we know at this point in time is that 7,100 individuals have gone to healthcare.gov and enrolled in an Oregon insurance plan since the start of the open enrollment period. An additional 12,000 or so have purchased a plan off exchange. This is a weekly data call that we've worked with the insurance division to gain from the carriers, and we'll continue to have this data call as the open enrollment period continues.
Just a question here. Last time, was open enrollment slow like it appears to be here?
So, Senator Moniz Anderson, you're exactly right. What we really learned from the last open enrollment period was that people will wait until the last moment, really, to pursue their coverage. So, while I don't have a direct comparison about how the first couple weeks have gone in comparison to the first couple weeks last year, I think given the challenges that we had with our technology, it's safe to say that having these numbers compared to where we were last year is a dramatic improvement. So, if you recall, the system wasn't working last year at this point in time.
Senator, may I ask a quick question? And Mr. Patnoid, do you know, of those 19,000 people, how many are new enrollees and how many are people who are re-upping from insurance that they purchased last year during open enrollment?
So Chair Monas Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I don't have that exact breakdown right now. I can look into the data call that the OID has done to see if that information is included.
Thanks. And it's not critical now, but I am curious to understand in the long term, especially when open enrollment's done, how good a job we did at reaching people who may not have been eligible or needed to purchase insurance for the exchange last year.
Absolutely. And I think as we go further through these slides, we do touch on some research that is done regarding the 2014 open enrollment period.
Great.
I think all of us at Cover Oregon and those of us that work in the state are obviously interested in having the same success that we were able to have last year, given the fact that we didn't even have a functioning technology.
Thank you.
So Cover Oregon has been conducting outreach and education activities in preparation for the open enrollment period and even during the first couple weeks of the open enrollment period. So prior to the start of the open enrollment period, Cover Oregon conducted a direct mail campaign with those consumers that went to Cover Oregon to pursue enrollment for 2014. So our rationale was if they came to us before, they're probably going to need to come to us again, so we should reach out to them and let them know what they need to do in order to enroll. We've also conducted a similar email campaign. We've worked with CMS, the insurance carriers here in the state, and also the Oregon Insurance Division to make sure that our outreach and messaging was all coordinated and saying the same thing, so we weren't further confusing the market about what folks needed to do. There has been a targeted public education campaign in coordination with healthcare.gov, so obviously working with our federal partners to ensure that we were in lockstep in terms of educating the consumers about what they need to do. This is advertising as well, so we've coordinated our advertising to have the similar messages. And the air dates for those advertisements from the federal government start November 17th and go through the 15th of December and then start back up in January. So obviously there's a little time taken off there for the holidays as people's purchasing practices typically are more focused on interest than pursuing health insurance. So Cover Oregon ads directing people to healthcare.gov have already started and have been active in the market on the radio, on the web, and also on television. So we have been hosting open enrollment events throughout different parts of the state. I have a slide a little bit later that has some information about upcoming open enrollment events as well.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Who's paying for the campaign? How much that's federal? How much of it is us?
So Chair Monas Anderson, Senator Cruz, Cover Oregon has budgeted dollars to pay for our Oregon-based advertising. That being said, the federal government also has done a national media buy to advertise healthcare.gov. So the federal government pays for their ads. We basically supplement their media buy with our own ads. So it's a little bit of a split. So they pay for some, we pay for some.
Yeah, ballpark. How much?
So Cover Oregon budgeted about $1.9 million for all advertising and outreach for the 2015 open enrollment period.
Madam Chair, some of the previous campaigns were a little less than spectacular.
The new one's great.
Well,
the new one's really good.
Yeah.
From what I've seen and from what I've heard of some of the target demographics, people really think it's great.
So the open enrollment events, we have had several open enrollment events and we'll continue to have open enrollment events as we approach that December 15th, the important December 15th deadline. So those enrollment events are staffed by Cover Oregon staff, insurance agents, folks that basically can help folks go through the enrollment process. So we've had events so far in Beaverton, Medford, Bend, Kaiser, and Portland. And you can see here the list of five upcoming events that we'll have, one taking place today, one tomorrow, and one on Wednesday. Our last event for this push of open enrollment will be this coming Saturday in Portland. So there are some other events being sponsored by community partners that are listed on the Cover Oregon website. So again, our interest is really ensuring that Oregonians have as much opportunity as they can to get the assistance they need to go through this process, if they would like to have that assistance going through the process. There's also a tool available on coveroregon.com that connects consumers with local help, whether it be a community partner or an insurance agent. Consumers can go to coveroregon.com, put in their zip code, a radius within they would like to search for assistance, and then it will return a number of agents or community partners that are available to provide that assistance. In addition, this year, consumers can actually schedule time with those specific individuals, an actual time, to help enroll. So an individual no longer just has to walk to an office and say, I'll wait in line here. Rather, they can schedule an actual time that they know when they show up at an office at that point in time that they'll be served and get their enrollment complete.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Patnod, I apologize for not giving you advance warning I was going to ask this question, mm-hmm. but I only learned late last week that we've got an issue with some agents who were helping people last year, even still not having been paid according to the agreements that they had. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that there are problems with people, with agents, with the system not connecting people. I understand that Cover Oregon has other priorities, but we've got agents who've taken the time to get trained and are working hard to get people enrolled, and they're missing out on tens of thousands of dollars that they're supposed to have been paid. Can you help me understand what's going on there and what the plan is to make those people whole for the work that they've done?
Chair Monas Anderson, Senator Steinert Hayward. Excuse
Sorry,
me.
Sorry, we're the long name committee.
I've got one cup of coffee this morning. You're exactly right. We do have this problem. However, we've been working since the beginning of the year to improve our commission payment process. It's a difference between how Cover Oregon was functioning in relation to the agents in 2014 and how we're functioning in 2015. So in 2015, the federal government is handling all the commission payment process. So this problem will not exist moving forward given the change of the technology. So while you said, you know, that this isn't a priority of ours right now, it's a priority of mine right now because these agents have done exceptional work for Cover Oregon and the state in enrolling people in 2014 coverage. Cover Oregon only pays commissions once they're received from the carriers to the agent. So we're a pass-through organization. And as soon as we get those commission payments, we make the payments directly to the agent. So unfortunately, until we receive those dollars from the carriers, we cannot pay them to the brokers because we don't have the dollars to pay them. So this is where agents may be experiencing a lag in their payments. So we are working in both directions on this one. So with the agents to ensure that we have an accurate inventory for whom they've been paid, whom they need to be paid for, et cetera. And then the other way as well, working with the carriers to say, we are missing payments for these particular enrollees that are due to these agents. So,
and if I may, Madam Chair, follow up, that's great, and that sounds like a really way we do it. My understanding is that there are some places where the connection between the enrollee and a given agent got dropped or mislabeled, or there was a problem because of the paperwork or something didn't get entered. How are those people being helped, those agents being helped?
Yeah, that's all part of our reconciliation process. So as we have an accurate, as we get the inventory of which enrollees are responsible to which agent, we then are working with the agents to ensure that their records are matching with our records. So it's an ongoing conversation one will have until the work is done. So
okay.
I'm not at a point where I'm comfortable asking anybody to stop work on this because there is a lot of work still to be done.
Okay. Thank you very much.
It's a good question. Excuse me. So part of Cover Oregon's role for the 2015 open enrollment period is also to provide support to partners and agents. So again, we've hosted trainings. The agents and community partners are required to go through training with healthcare.gov. So there's been a lot of pre-work is the real message from this slide going into the preparation for this open enrollment period to ensure that Oregonians have the resources they need in order to get enrolled in coverage. So how do we do in 2014? This is just kind of a summary slide of where we've been since October 1st. So this the numbers that you see here represent the time period from October 1st through December 1st, October 1st, 2013 through December 1st of 2014. So total medical enrollments going through Cover Oregon. Again, these are only through Cover Oregon. It doesn't represent any external market numbers. We're 448,839. About 107,000 of those were private insurance enrollees that came through Cover Oregon, and 341,000 were OHP enrollees that came through Cover Oregon. In addition, we've had almost 21,000 folks enroll in dental coverage for the 2014 plan year. So while the last slide was the entire time period, representing October 1st through December 1st, what you're looking at here on this slide is a point in time number. So as so on December 1st, 2014, 76,601 individuals had gone to enroll in a plan in Cover Oregon. So these we consider our point in time enrollees. Of those 76,000 individuals, 68,000 had actually paid their first month's premium. So we use a term called effectuated, their coverage. So they've paid a month's premium, which gets us to an effectuation rate of 89.5%. And an industry standard is about 80 to 90%. So this is actually right in line with the industry standard for effectuated coverage. I've included some demographic information as we've gone and met with folks and spoken with them over the phone in preparation for these meetings. Folks are interested in what the makeup of the enrollees is. So I'm not going to talk through these slides, but please know that they're in your deck for reference. Male and female breakdown, metal tier breakdown, those that receive financial assistance, those that did not, and then an age banding of the enrollees that we've seen. And this data, I just need to say, is relative to the November 1st enrollment numbers. So there was an enrollee study commissioned by Cover Oregon. We worked with the Center for Outcomes Research and Education at Providence to do some research regarding the enrollees. So three study objectives: understanding the enrollment, so who enrolled, why did they enroll, understanding connections to care, so how connected were people to coverage. So we know that there were a lot of concerns about provider availability, et cetera, given the need for everybody to have insurance, and also the health of enrollees. So again, these are very data-heavy slides, so I'm just going to touch on some of the key points from them. On this slide, understanding enrollment, so 53% of those private enrollees that came to Cover Oregon prior to coming to Cover Oregon did not have insurance coverage. Let me do that one again. So of the people that came to Cover Oregon seeking private coverage, 53% of them did not have coverage before they came to us. Of those, 38% were uninsured for 12 months or more prior to coming to Cover Oregon. So these are statistics that we as an organization are very proud of, and we feel are our contribution really to 95% of the folks in the state having insurance coverage or some form of coverage.
How much of that was just Medicaid expansion, though?
So Senator Mona Anderson, Senator Cruz, these just represent private enrollees. So
that's just private. So that's
just private,
that's
enrollees.
That's not Medicaid.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So why did people switch? The big takeaway from this slide was primarily based on affordability. So this, again, is something that we found during the 2014 open enrollment period, is that price is king. So people are shopping based upon price. And again, I'm going to go through these. I want to make sure we get to all the information. So connections to care. So after enrolling, people were more likely to say they now had a usual place to go to receive health care. So this was a great finding for us, again, given that concern that would there be enough supply for all these newly insured to receive the care that they could. So there were increases in those data points. Health profiles. Overall, what was found by the study that was commissioned was that the people that enrolled in the private coverage were typically healthier compared to those people who enrolled in Medicaid coverage. So just some data on that topic here. And again, I'm happy to address any questions afterwards. I just want to be mindful of our time here. So a summary of the key findings regarding enrollment. So over half of enrollees were uninsured before signing up. Of those who already had coverage, most came to Cover Oregon looking for more affordable choices. Regarding connections to care, unmet healthcare need due to cost were a problem prior to enrolling, especially for minorities and low-income populations. So signing up ultimately helped connect people to the care that they needed. And regarding health outcomes, or the health of enrollees, new QHPs enrollees seem to be healthier than populations who participated in recent studies regarding Medicaid or the uninsured in Oregon. So, all right, regarding the advanced premium tax credit issue that we brought to the committee last time we were here. Just for some brief background, so Cover Oregon made errors calculating advanced premium tax credits. Those are the financial assistance available to individuals living between 138 and 400% of the federal poverty level. The problem that we reported last time is actually larger than was initially reported. So unfortunately, we needed to go back and look at our data again and found that our estimation was much below what the impact of the error actually is. We have contracted with an external party to do an independent analysis of the problem, and we have developed a plan to help all those households that are impacted by this error.
So that plan is, because I know statements have been made by various legislators that there's no way that they want any of these people to have to pay back any money. What does your plan say?
Sure. Senator Montez Anderson, it's a great question. So, and one of the important things that we need to remember with advanced premium tax credit and this error that Cover Oregon has made is that advanced premium tax credit was always based upon an estimation. It was always based upon a household's projected income. And there's actually no way for us or even the household to know what the actual impact of this error will be until they receive their W-2, make adjustments to their taxes, whether it be deductions, et cetera, and actually file their taxes to know if they have what the extent of the error will be on those households. So at this point in time, it's impossible for us really to understand what the impact is on a specific household because those numbers are still to be determined for each household. That being said, we've developed a plan to help work around that. So if I may, I'll talk through the plan, and I think it may help answer your question. Excuse me. So as you asked, our plan is to make any person harmed by this miscalculation whole. The actual impact of the mistake can't be determined until a person actually files their taxes, just like I just mentioned. Advanced premium tax credit is based upon projected income, and the actual taxable income amount is necessary to determine the actual tax credit. So again, until a household receives their W-2 from their employer and actually goes through the process of filing their taxes, it's impossible for us or the household to know what the extent of the error really is. So Cover Oregon's plan is to communicate with all these households.
Senator Ticano.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aaron, tell me what you mean by Cover Oregon's goal is to make any person harmed by our miscalculation whole.
Sure.
What does that mean?
So, Senator Mona Anderson, Senator Knope, our intent is to work with households who identify the error and say, we have been negatively impacted by this. We are out X number of dollars to have the effort made to ensure that the error that Cover Oregon has committed to these households is actually corrected. So...
follow up. So no determination has been made about whether or not they're going to have to make up the difference in the miscalculation?
So Senator Mona's Anderson, Senator Knope, for those households who have been negatively impacted by this miscalculation, Cover Oregon will make up the difference. It's impossible for us to know that difference right now because households have not received their W-2s, and until they actually file their taxes, it's impossible for us or the household to know if they've been negatively impacted by this error.
Follow up. So tell me who then who ultimately is paying then. If they're not going to pay what technically they owed, even though there was a mistake made, then who is paying? Cover Oregon doesn't print its own money, so who is paying for that?
So you're right. Cover Oregon does not print its own money. What we have done over the course of 2014 open enrollment is generate revenue that is designed to help sustain the business moving forward. As we've planned our 2015 budget, we have allocated resources from that revenue that's been generated with the intent of covering the cost of these errors. In addition, we've also been in communication with our insurer to determine if there's any possibility for coverage via our insurance policy to cover these errors.
So follow up. So the revenue that Cover Oregon has generated, are you referring to the per member per month fee or are you referring to something beyond that?
Senator Montez Anderson, Senator Canope, it would only be taken from the per member per month revenue.
Okay, so at the end of the day then, what we're doing is we're spreading the cost of the mistake amongst all the members who signed up and paid the per member per month fee. Is that correct?
Senator Montez Anderson, Senator Canope, I guess that's one way to look at it. It's revenue that was generated for Cover Oregon to use for operations moving forward. Since it is derived from the per member per month fee, I think it's fair to say that, you know, it could be viewed as spreading it among everybody.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so Cover Oregon's plan. Cover Oregon is required by the federal government actually to send tax forms. It's referred to as a 1095 tax form. It's a new form this year that all advanced premium tax credit eligible households will receive. We're required to send those out to all households no later than January 31st. Cover Oregon's plan is to communicate with that tax form messaging related to, number one, what the tax form is, number two, that if you're eligible for advanced premium tax credit and by virtue of receiving this tax form, you are, you may have been negatively impacted by an error that Cover Oregon made in calculating your advanced premium tax credit, and ultimately communicating with those households to let them know what they need to do in order to file a claim if they have been negatively impacted by the tax credit error.
Madam Chair, you just confused me there because you've been saying that we aren't going to know who's eligible until after the fact, and then he just said you're going to send out this new form to everybody who's eligible. I don't understand that. You don't know who's eligible, but yeah, you're going to send out a form to those who are.
So, Senator Montez Anderson,
it is
Senator Cruz, I understand your confusion. And what we're doing, what we do know is how many households were eligible for advanced premium tax credits. So we will be communicating with all of those households that were eligible for advanced premium tax credits, regardless of if we feel like they may have had an error or may not have had an error. So in essence, what we're doing is looking at the total population of households that could potentially be impacted by this and communicating with all of them so that they all know what they need to do if they have been negatively impacted by the error.
But it's still to the point, if you look at all who have enrolled, you don't know at this point in time who's eligible until they get their W-2s and go through all that process. So somebody who was not eligible last year could be eligible this year, but so if you're basing it on your population here, you may be missing those. So I'm just wondering how you make that connection.
Sure. Senator Cruz, this is all related to the 2014 taxable income. So when an individual went to enroll, they projected their 2014 income. So from that projected income number, we know what the potential population of people that are eligible for tax credits are. We will communicate with all 43,000 of those households to ensure that they know what they need to know if they feel like they've been negatively impacted by this error.
Understanding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that brings up another question, Mr. Patnod, and this probably displays my ignorance about how the tax credit is calculated, but imagine, if you will, that somebody is one spouse is unemployed but looking for employment when they project their 2014 income. Mm-hmm. But fortunately gets employed early in the year, and their family's income changes from 200% of the federal poverty level to 300% of the federal poverty level in the course of 2014. That would result in a change in their APTC, but not through the fault of Cover Oregon, because you would have made a calculation based on what they told you. So they may be affected, but not because of something you collectively, not you, sir, calculated. And how are you going to be able to distinguish between those two groups of people?
So Senator Montez Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward.
You're doing great.
That's a great example. So all individuals, regardless of if they are APTC eligible or not, upon pursuing coverage through Cover Oregon, were required to file income changes if they had them over the course of the year, which, if they were APTC eligible, would change the amount of tax credit that they were eligible for. The example that you provided is exactly why we can't do anything at this point in time, because until that household actually files their taxes, receives their W-2, and files their taxes, there's no way for us to know what the extent of the impact is for a specific household. I think that's the perfect example, and this isn't something that's unique to Oregon.
Right.
This is to every state in the United States. There's no way for any state at this point in time to know exactly what the impact is to a household because the tax filing season hasn't taken place yet. And until a consumer actually files their taxes, there's no way to know what the extent of the accuracy of the advanced premium tax credit is or isn't.
Follow up, if I may, Madam Chair. I don't mean to belabor this, mm-hmm. but this is an issue for us and our constituents and mm-hmm. you all. If somebody filed an income change during the year, do you think that the subsequent calculation was done correctly, or do you think that that was also done incorrectly?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, it depends at what point in time they made that change. So upon identifying the error, Cover Oregon did correct the formula we were using in our calculator to be accurate and use the correct methodology. So it depends at what point in time they made that correction.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. So claims will be processed. A claims process is being put in place right now prior to issuing that 1095 tax form, excuse me, that I mentioned earlier. So our intent is to have this process completely in place so when individuals do get that communication about what they need to do in order to file a claim, that they have everything they need in order to do that and be evaluated if they are eligible to be made whole on these errors. We are also training our customer service staff to be ready to answer questions related not just to the 1095 form, but also to the claims process that will be in place that individuals can apply to be made whole on this error. And that was the last of the material I had provided, so I'll stop there and see if there are any additional questions.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And pardon me, some things, being just a simple country boy, some things confuse me. Explain to me, I mean, the Affordable Care Act was relatively explicit in saying that tax credits were only available to those states with their own exchanges. Mm-hmm. We are now going to the federal exchange, but somehow there's a loophole that's allowing us, you know, I'm concerned about that. Of course, the other issue is what the Supreme Court's going to say about that, mm-hmm. too. So I'm not quite sure I understand the loophole that allows mm-hmm. us to be in the federal exchange and still say we're not.
Yeah. So Senator Montes Anderson, Senator Cruz, I understand your question. I've answered a number of times for a number of different folks, so please don't think you're alone in your lack of understanding it or confusion, if you will. But Oregon is actually a state-based marketplace. We are still a state-based marketplace today, and the federal government actually recognizes us as a state-based marketplace moving forward. So I just spoke with the CEO of healthcare.gov on Friday regarding this topic, actually. The Supreme Court decision and the availability of tax credits, and the question here is whether they should be, those tax credits are to be made available for those federally facilitated marketplaces. So there are 35 states here that rely completely upon the federal government to maintain their marketplace. We are not one of those 35 states. We are a state-based marketplace. The ruling that the Supreme Court will apply specifically to those 35 other states that do rely wholly on healthcare.gov and the federally facilitated marketplace to run the marketplace. So that being said, we'll be watching the Supreme Court conversation decision very closely in the event that they make a determination about any of the other marketplaces that are not using, that are not federally facilitated marketplaces.
Madam Chair, I've heard that explanation before, but it still doesn't get me there because you are either a state-run exchange or you're part of the federal exchange. Mm-hmm. We have transitioned to the federal exchange. I think we're splitting hairs by saying we're still state-based at that point, aren't we?
My view of this is we're actually contracting for the IT piece. We're still state-based, but the IT piece is with the feds.
So Senator Manos Anderson, I think that's a great way of looking at it. So we've basically entered into a vendor-based relationship with a website provider, which is healthcare.gov. All the other functions of the marketplace are retained by the state of Oregon. So we've, in essence, entered into a relationship with a website to sell our insurance products, which allows us to maintain our state-based marketplace.
Okay, so I have not seen it yet, but I know it's out there. There's a piece of legislation floating somewhere relative to Cover Oregon. Does that change anything?
I think that's, Senator Cruz, I think that's a conversation that the new joint interim committee will take up on Wednesday. So I'm sure Senator Manos Anderson or Senator Steiner Hayward would be happy to tell you more about it. But Cover Oregon will also be participating in that conversation on Wednesday.
That bill's on the list, Senator, for the committee on Wednesday, if you're so inclined to read it.
Yeah. The joint
paper.
Interim Committee on Health Insurance Transition.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Aaron, in your slides, you had an age-banding slide. And I guess my question to you is, do you or Cover Oregon see any potential issues about financial sustainability based on the age banding, who is signed up, and their age? Because it looked very top-heavy of those 45-plus.
Sure. Yep. Yes, Senator Manos Anderson, Senator Knope, that's a great question. So I think regardless of the state of Oregon, looking at just the state of Oregon or from a national perspective, I think overwhelmingly what all states have seen is that while we anticipated having younger, healthy enrollees come into the system, the distribution has been more focused on the older population, so people that are potentially seeking transitional coverage before they enroll in Medicare. Does it impact our financial sustainability or not? Does the age band impact our financial sustainability or not? It's difficult to say at this point in time. So our financial sustainability is based upon achieving a specific number of enrollments or a forecasted enrollment. And regardless of what the age banding is, the PMPM is paid out regardless. So I think moving forward, what the marketplace needs to do is plan for the difference in the age band of population that we're seeing come to us compared to what we anticipated that age banding looking at before. However, it should not have a negative impact on our revenue.
Madam Chair, the issue is not what the impact on Cover Oregon, the issue is the impact on the market.
But if I may, Madam Chair, it's my understanding, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, that the intention was never for this to hit exactly the target distribution in the first year. I mean, the understanding, if I was, that this was going to take 3 to 5 years to reach sort of a steady state and to reach all the key marketplaces. We have a long history in this country of people in their 20s not having health insurance, and that's going to take a while to turn around. It may also be that some of the projections may have changed because those 18 to 26-year-olds or 21 to 26-year-olds are now covered a lot more under their parents' insurance, since that was a component of the Affordable Care Act as well. So those people are in the market, and they are part of the risk pool. They're just not through the independent piece of it. And most of the companies, at least, pretty much all the companies in Oregon, at least, that are offering products in the marketplace are also offering commercial products through employer-based insurance where people might be covered under their parents' insurance as well. Am I correct in all of that, Mr. Patton?
So Senator Manos Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, you're exactly right. So, I think, taking a step back and looking at Oregon as a whole and insurance coverage or healthcare coverage as a state, the research has shown that 95% of individuals and people in the state are covered by some form of insurance, which means that there are about 200,000 people that are not. Now, I don't think it's safe to say that all 200,000 of those people are the 18 to 25-year-olds, what many people refer to as the young and healthies. But what we as a state need to do is figure out what we need to do in order to maintain that 95%. 100% coverage and potentially gain the rest of those 200,000 people into some form of coverage. To me, I think that's the important goal here. Whether an individual or a household seeks coverage through the insurance marketplace, whether they purchase off exchange, or whether they're Medicare or Medicaid eligible, I think what's most important is that we as a state come up with a mechanism to ensure that folks are getting enrolled in the coverage that's appropriate for them.
Thank you very much. I know we have a lot of other questions, but because we're in limbo now with another committee on what's going to happen to Cover Oregon, this is the information that we really wanted to know. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your time. I was happy to be here again.
All right. Thank you. With that, we'll go on to the second item in the agenda, which is Health Systems Transformation Update. And if I could call Suzanne Hoffman, Judy Moore Peterson, and Lori Koiner.
Yeah, actually I can, basically.
And, yes.
You do that. Wait, where are you going? Where are the other people here?
You guys handle it for a couple of seconds. I'm going to get my eyes.
I'm wearing informational, so it doesn't really matter how many of us are here. If Cruz went to smoke, I'm going to kill. Kill both of them. Oh, Lord. Ready?
Take it away.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Suzanne Hoffman, and I'm the interim director for the Oregon Health Authority. With me today are Judy Moore Peterson, Oregon's Medicaid director, and Lori Koiner, our director of health analytics. I'm going to really just introduce today's session and perhaps help with questions along the way, but really most of the bulk of today's presentation is going to be delivered by my two colleagues who are the subject matter experts in these areas. Health system transformation is large, and we could talk about it all day with you, all different facets, but given that we only have a short time, we are zeroing in on a couple of areas we think would be of greatest interest to you and that we were advised were of most interest to you at this time. One is talking about the renewals for the Oregon Health Plan, or what most know by the term redeterminations, at least touch on that to let you know where we are and our plan going forward, to talk about the transition to the federal marketplace, and to talk about coordinated care organizations, in particular the quality metrics, where we are, and what happens next with that. So I'll turn it over to Judy. Oh, I'm sorry. I will remind everyone of some numbers that were accurate as of the first week of December. 95%, as Mr. Patnode said, 95% of all Oregonians are insured. We have, as of December 1st, 972,000 Oregon Health Plan members, and that's an increase of 359,000 since December of 2013. And 90% of those new Oregon Health Plan members are in coordinated care organizations. Judy.
Hi, good morning. For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the state's Medicaid director with the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm going to cover a little bit about where we are with the renewals and redeterminations, and then I'm actually going to move along to talk about where we are in the transition project after that. It's a good timing to follow up on what Mr. Patnode has already covered, but let me start off with the renewals and redeterminations. Just as a reminder, last year about this time, we had actually requested deferrals for the renewals for people who had been traditionally eligible for Medicaid and on Medicaid. And in order to be able to focus on getting people enrolled. And so, like other states, we did that. And so now we are at the point where we are needing to go through those renewals for those individuals, along with other people who would have come up for their renewal at this time period. So most enrollees, we actually asked CMS for another type of a waiver in order to do these renewals using an expedited process. That expedited process just asks them if they've had any kind of a change in their household or their income over the past year or currently, and then compared to last year. And then if they do not, then we are able to automatically update them and get them redetermined and renewed at that time period. If they do not, or if they do report that they have a change, then they need to go through the process of filling in a new application, and we will go ahead and redetermine them at once we receive their new application.
Senator Hayward. I'm so sorry, Madam Chair. Ms. Moore-Peterson, again, this is something I learned late last week, so I apologize for not giving you a heads up, and if you don't have an answer now, that's cool. But I was at the Westside Economic Alliance last week, and one of the people there said that the problem, I think they were a certified agent, and they said they had people coming in, and if they were Medicaid eligible, that when they did the new application and renew through healthcare.gov, it kind of disappeared into limbo, and they didn't, then people were waiting for a long time, and they were apprehensive about whether they were really eligible or not. Whether it was a new application, you know, a brand new application or an expedited one, and now they were worried because it was getting close to December 15th and they didn't have a determination and they wanted to be sure that they enrolled in time to have coverage on January 1st. So could you help update us on that, please? If you can. If you can't, email is fine afterwards.
Chair Montes Anderson, Senator Stein Hayward, I'm trying to figure out which piece of that. People who apply through healthcare.gov, actually, there's no discrepancy and their application was able to be verified for income or other things, they should get a notice right away that says that they are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan.
Okay.
We do know of some instances in which the individuals, there was some issue with their income, and so those individuals then are referred back to us to the state.
Okay.
to do an actual determination to verify their income and then to do a determination. Those cases are referred back to us when there's been a significant drop in income, so meaning that they're more likely to be eligible for Medicaid. However, until they're actually able to get their income verified, we don't know. We're in the process of getting that information from the feds, and then once we do, we'll start working through that. We should be able to work through that relatively quickly once we get that information.
Great. Thank you very much. Proceed.
Okay. Other than the people who went through the expedited process who did have a change, the other individuals who need to fill in a full application are those, as you may recall, we used a process called the Fast Track, where those are individuals who had either SNAP coverage or they were parents of children who were covered under the Oregon Health Plan. And those individuals also need to go through a full application process. And so we are in the middle of doing that, and they are being referred to healthcare.gov, actually through first they're being referred to, and I'll cover this in a little bit, to OregonHealthcare.gov, and then in the majority of cases they're going to healthcare.gov. In that process, we're using several different means of doing some direct outreach. We send out the letter. We send out a reminder letter. We have been doing some phone calls. The CCOs have been getting information about that, their members who are up for renewal redetermination, and doing some outreach. We've used the media, and then one of our strongest aspects is also working with our community partners. We have some Q&A and also some additional information that's also available at OregonHealthcare.gov. So, there are cases, as you heard earlier, where people, I think it's a bit of human nature to leave it to the last minute, and they don't reapply in time, and they wind up getting their application or their coverage terminated. However, they are able to reapply, and if they're still eligible, then we will reinstate them back to that their date of the application. Also, if they've had any sort of medical expenses during that time period, during that gap, and then they would have been eligible for Medicaid, then we will also cover those medical expenses. So that's what's going on with renewals and redeterminations. It's quite a bit of work that's going on right now on that particular topic. And at the same time, we've also been partnering and also with Cover Oregon and also the transition to using healthcare.gov. We did do that on November 15th. That transition is complete so that people who are eligible for Medicaid can go through that healthcare.gov to apply for Medicaid. And healthcare.gov has started to process those applications. We first have them go to direct them to OregonHealthcare.gov for sending people for the right place to apply, whether it's directing them straight to healthcare.gov or directing them to OregonHealthcare.gov to fill out a PDF application. So this is actually a better slide for that. That probably helps a little bit. Because we are required to, the Medicaid program is required to have our own front door. That's why we have our companion site of OregonHealthcare.gov that provides better door screening, et cetera. And the majority of people are likely going to be directed to healthcare.gov, but there are examples of individuals who are better served locally, filling in a local application. Examples are those individuals who are disabled, or who need long-term care supports and services. They're better served locally, where they can get hooked up with services right away. So the other part of our project, the transition project, is a new part, and that's, as many of you already are well aware, that we will be now importing technology and a system from another state that was implemented successfully in another state. We are currently evaluating, or we have evaluated, what's the best option for that. We will need to, as I mentioned earlier, we need to have a local online application, a streamlined way for those enrollments to occur, and that those enrollments need to be interfaced with the current Oregon Health Authority systems, and our intent is to have that complete by late fall of 2015. We were looking for a system that was the lowest risk and that could be most successfully implemented here, and that essentially that the code, by using from another state that's been successfully implemented from another state, the documentation and the code itself from that other state is no cost to Oregon. And in that process, through that evaluation process, we've actually chosen another state, and that's Kentucky. We've started that work now to evaluate. They have had a very successful exchange that also does their Medicaid programs as well. This is their cover page. So they've we will be using just the Medicaid portions of it. While they are a state-based exchange, we will not be importing that aspect of it. We will be importing only the Medicaid, the MAGI Medicaid portions of those modules. We based our selection criteria on a state that was most like us, policy-wise, as well as it had the most the kinds of functionality that we were looking for, and that most closely met that criteria. The Medicaid program in Kentucky they're also an expansion state. Their population, their Medicaid population, is very close to what Oregon's is. They have a variety of the functionality that we've been looking for and working to implement, and they've also been called out as one of the most successful systems and system implementations in the country. Currently, we're working on the scope and knowing, trying to figure out and doing an assessment of what we will need to change, as well as what will need to get developed in order to adapt that system here in Oregon. Examples of the kinds of things that we'll be looking at, or that obviously will need to be adapted for Oregon, is it's everything from obviously replacing the Kentucky with Oregon, as well as developing the interfaces that we need to adapt it to our system, our legacy systems that it have to be interfaced with. So we're also in the process of looking at what kind of interfaces we'll need and will need to be developed. And that's what that aspect is. It is this what's known as the fit gap analysis, and we're in the middle of doing that. And just as another note for you all to know is that we are also putting out a new RFP. I believe it's actually out right now for a new quality assurance vendor for this portion of the transition project, and that a new quality assurance vendor will be hopefully on place in January. Now, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Lori, Lori Corner. Okay. I'm going to trade places with her, though.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Lori Coyner, Director of Health Analytics for the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here just to give an update on the coordinated care organization metrics with a focus on two things. One is the incentive metrics and how the experience was observed for the first year of the program. And then I'm going to be highlighting what's coming up for 2015. So you may recall that their CCOs are held accountable for 17 incentive metrics, and they are were paid in 2013. 2% of all their expenditures were held as part of a quality pool and paid based on their performance on those 17 metrics. So in the first year, 11 of the 15 CCOs earned 100% of their quality pool payments. One of the CCOs earned 70% based on their performance, and three earned 80%. We saw improvement on all 14 of the metrics that were reported. The other three are what we call clinical quality metrics, and we have to obtain those from electronic medical records. And so the CCOs were all paid for reporting on those three metrics, and so they the results were not included in the report because we paid for reporting, and they had to submit a, what we called a proof of concept set of data.
Wait, I'm so sorry. I apologize, Madam Chair. I don't understand what you just said to me. So when you say that 11 out of the 15... I'm sorry. I'm really having trouble tracking this one. I should know better. But when you said they were paid for reporting, they weren't paid for actual outcomes? Am I missing, are there two separate things here? Help me understand.
Senator Monis Anderson, Senator Sonia Hayward, they are two different things, so let me slow down a little. The when we calculate the quality pool, we calculated it for all 17 metrics. Three of those metrics were paid for reporting, and the other 14 were based on performance.
Thank you. That's much clearer. Appreciate it.
We also have a set of 33 metrics that the Oregon Health Authority is held accountable and reports to CMS. And of those other 17 metrics, we saw improvement as a state on all. There were two measures, except for two measures, and those two we did not see improvements in either statewide and none of the CCOs improved on those. Those two measures are cervical cancer screening and chlamydia screening, and it's likely staff is now digging in to understand more about that data, but the it may be due to changes in Preventive Services Task Force guidelines around cervical cancer screening. All or nearly all of the CCOs improved on the following metrics on the slide. All CCOs met their improvement targets for improving reducing emergency department utilization. All CCOs met their improvement targets, and four met the benchmark for developmental screening. All CCOs were below their benchmark, where lower is better, for early elective delivery, and all CCOs met their improvement targets or surpass the benchmark for adoption of electronic health records. Also, all CCOs but one met the had over 60% of their members enrolled in a patient-centered primary care home. There were mixed results on a number of the measures. Adolescent well child visits, seven of the CCOs met their targets. Colorectal cancer screening, six CCOs met their improvement targets. Follow-up after hospitalization for mental illness, 10 of the 15 CCOs met targets. Follow-up for care for children prescribed ADHD medication, 13 of the CCOs met their targets. Assessment for children in DHS custody, 12 met targets. Timely prenatal care, 11 met their targets. And satisfaction with care, 12 CCOs made improvements. The CCOs, we had lower results on the ESPERT measure, which stands for screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. That is a measure that assesses drug and alcohol screening. And also there were fewer CCOs that met targets for access. And that was based on a patient experience survey. So moving forward, I will remind you that we have a metrics and scoring committee that was established through statute. It has 9 members that are selected by the governor's office. 3 of those members represent CCOs. 3 of the members are measurement experts, and 3 of the members are at large. And they are responsible for selecting the 17 incentive measures for the CCOs. And they continue to meet after they establish the first set of 17 measures to monitor progress, look at data, hear public testimony from people who in the community and staff who are interested in having the committee think about new measures, and then monitor and change the program moving forward as necessary. We also have an ad hoc work group called the Technical Advisory Group that has more detailed expertise, and then often they will make recommendations that they send to metrics and scoring for consideration. For 2014, metrics and scoring committee opted to keep the measures the same as they were for 2013, but they've opted also now for 2015 to make some changes to the measurement set. They've retired early elective delivery and follow-up after medication for ADHD. Both of those, the early elective delivery measure, all of the CCOs were nearly all were below the benchmark, and the state average is about 2.5%, and the benchmark was 5%, and the feeling by the committee was that there isn't any more ability to reduce that. And so they're monitoring for 2014, and then we'll retire that measure in 2015. Follow-up after medication for ADHD was retired for 2 reasons. As a state, we are below the benchmark, and then in terms of more detailed look at the measure, many of the CCOs have small numbers, and it's hard to track and change in progress over time when we have very few people in that measure every year. They added two new measures for 2015. One is dental sealants for children. Part of our waiver required us to add an incentive measure now that the CCOs have, are responsible for dental. And the second measure is effective contraceptive use for women who do not desire pregnancy. We also have what's called a challenge pool, and that's the way methodology for making sure that we distribute the entire quality pool every year, so we do not hold any back. It's completely distributed to the CCOs. And the Metrics and Scoring Committee selects measures that they think are the most transformative, and they added, they took out patient-centered primary care home because most CCOs now are up around 80% of their members are enrolled in a certified patient-centered primary care home, and they instead put replace that with developmental screening. And the reason for that was that it adds a child-focused measure in the challenge pool, as well as dovetailing with the governor's focus on early learning. We also have started to expand our metrics program beyond the Oregon Health Plan. So an incentive measures program is being established among the state employees, and new contracts with metrics begin January 1st, 2015 for PEB. And OEB, we are working on that. We will be working on that piece as we renew contracts in the next year. There's also been a hospital quality pool program that was established, and it includes CCO hospital coordination measures. And then now that the CCOs receive these quality pool payments, we've been working with them on developing alternate payment methodologies to distribute those incentive dollars. We have another progress report coming out. It will be released mid to late January. It will include 2014 measures. We will have expanded information on cost and utilization, and also have some information about the first 6 months with a focus on the Affordable Care Act expansion and the new enrollees in the Oregon Health Plan. And that concludes the information that I have.
I just have one question, and that is what I'm receiving from some constituents. There's a not consistency of coverage depending on what who the contracts are made with their local providers. And I'll cite an example. There is a person who was in health share and was getting drug treatment program, but then when he moved to Willamette, they didn't contract with the same provider that was here, and I'm wondering what kind of work is being done with trying to make sure, especially with mental health and drug treatment, that there's consistency in being able to keep their same provider.
You want me to take that one? This is Judy Moore Peterson for the record. Chair Monica Anderson, I think when individuals are with a particular coordinated care organization, the state is outlining that they have to provide these particular services, that they need to have access to those services, and they need to have a full provider panel, et cetera. We also have requirements that they do coordination if they're going to be moving from one coordinated care organization to another coordinated care organization. However, if you're moving from one part of the state to a different part of the state, it is not always possible to stay with the same treatment providers, so we do see that sometimes that can be an issue. I think that for the most part, the coordinated care organizations themselves work hard to try to maintain that coordination and that continuity of care. But you're describing moving from one geographic area to a different geographic area, and there's going to be a different provider panels in those different areas.
Well, this was the same provider panel, except that Willamette wouldn't contract with this particular provider, even though it was located in Salem. So that's the issue that I am concerned about. And what I might do is just offline send you the information regarding that.
We'd be happy to take a look at that. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Three things off subject, but this is the only OHA panel we have here for today. And I would, just based on some correspondence I have had, I would be interested in any information on changes to the prioritized list that are coming up in January. I think that's kind of important. And I would also like the health authorities read on what the senator and I have been working on relative to school-based health centers and school nurses, potentially moving them into CCOs. So we would like a read on that. And probably the third thing that actually has been in the news some would be this sex education conference. It's gotten a whole lot of news, and I know the health authority has some money in it. What I don't want to do is go off just based on little bits of information. I would like for a full report on that in the next session.
Okay. Sandy has that.
Okay. That's all.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to have the status report on Senate Bill 21. Mike McCormick, please. Yeah, the long-term care plan.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike McCormick, and I'm the director of the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within the Department of Human Services. So thank you for having me here today to provide an update on Senate Bill 21. To refresh everyone's memory, Senate Bill 21 was passed in the 2013 legislative session, and it required the department to work with stakeholders to develop a plan to modernize and improve Oregon's system of long-term care. So before I get started, the world of aging and people with disabilities is significantly different than 18 months ago. The legislature has made significant investments into our programs through the legislatively adopted budget, through all of the new initiatives, through the special purpose appropriation for seniors, and really some great new investments and strategies towards improving Oregon's system. So in September, we formed the steering committee. It consisted of 15 consumer advocates and providers and four state legislators. We've met 10 times from October through August. We formed four subcommittees. The first looked at the assessment information and eligibility for long-term care services. The next looked at data and research that the department uses in administering our long-term care programs. The next one looked at caregivers and the support that we provide to them. And the last one was service equity. How do we ensure different populations across Oregon achieve equitable outcomes in our long-term care systems? So the subcommittee or the steering committee met extensively over this time period. And ultimately, the recommendations that were formed followed the language that was in Senate Bill 21. So the first objective out of Senate Bill 21 was to develop strategies to support consumers to stay in their own homes and communities. So one of the key debates that we had in our in the Senate Bill 21 committee was, how do we change federal policies that are very biased towards institutional care? There was a strong desire to influence legislation and to ensure that all consumers have the right to receive services in home and community-based settings. For context, in Oregon, only about 14% of our long-term care population is receiving services in institutional settings. The other 86% is receiving them in community-based care, at least adult foster homes, assisted living, et cetera, and their own homes. Yet, despite those outcomes, federal policies still have a strong bias towards institutional care. There was a desire to initiate a dialogue about changing that policy, but there was equal belief that access to institutional care needed to remain protected. So there was a lot of work around access to quality caregivers. If we're going to continue to serve more and more people independently in home and community-based settings, we have to make sure that we're building the workforce that will support that. Also, how do we support family caregivers? I think about 95% of long-term care in Oregon is provided basically free of charge by family caregivers, and how do we support them so we protect that valuable asset in our system? How do we continue to improve the coordination of our system with the healthcare system? There was a significant amount of work that was already done on this, and now we're need to figure out a plan to implement all of the recommendations associated with that. We need greater access to technology and adaptive equipment for consumers. And one thing that continually came up and came up through the recently completed tour is that we need better access to transportation, especially in rural areas for seniors and people with disabilities. The next objective that was called for in Senate Bill 21 was how do we support consumers to achieve and maintain independence? And there was a discussion and consensus that we need a greater emphasis on preventative services. This includes better education, better investments in keeping people healthier for a longer period of time. The next recurring theme that has come up is that we need to increase access to housing. This is a systemic issue throughout the state of Oregon, and we need to increase our access to that. But when consumers are staying in their own homes, they tend to be isolated. So we need to figure out strategies that increase community integration and reduce isolation for that population. There was support that Oregonians need to know where to go when the need for long-term care arises. So today, if someone needed long-term care in a crisis situation, they likely wouldn't know who to call. They may call a friend or a family or do a Google search. What the vision is to create a ubiquitous aging and disability resource connection network throughout Oregon that Oregonians know about. They know to call them when their needs arise, and the ADRC would be responsive to meet the needs of the consumer. And yes, there was a great a deal of discussion about creating age-friendly communities. So to the extent that you've created an age-friendly community, you're going to increase the likelihood that an individual is going to stay in their own community independently for a longer period of time. The last objective called for in Senate Bill 21 was to serve all people and cultures in a culturally and linguistically responsive manner, in a manner that they choose. So this is an initiative throughout all of Department of Human Services, trying to increase service equity for the populations that we serve. This is about not treating people equally. It's about ensuring that the outcomes that each individual achieves are equal regardless of the population being served. So we recognized that we needed to build a workforce. This includes providers, our case managers, our staff that is culturally responsive for the diverse population that we serve in Oregon. How do we, there are lots of cultural differences in Oregon about different cultures and their willingness or motivation to access publicly funded long-term care services. And in some cultures, it's really frowned upon. So in order to take advantage of that wonderful asset that we have in Oregon, how do we support that population and in supporting their family in the manner that they've chosen? We need to build relationships with diverse communities. I think this is something a lot of areas have in DHS have room to improve upon, including in aging and people with disabilities. So building the relationships, building trust so that when the government comes to assist, they're not afraid of us knocking on their door. And then we have to improve our data collection around who we're serving and the manner in which they've prefer. So right now, we have taken these recommendations out throughout Oregon. I think we conducted 16 meetings throughout Oregon, some well-attended, some not well-attended. The results of all of those meetings are now being summarized by our staff. I can tell you the recurring theme that came up through all of the surveys is the need for greater housing supports and greater transportation, neither of which my program has direct responsibility for, but we can certainly influence and partner with other organizations to help improve access in those areas. Our plan is to present the survey results and a draft report that ultimately needs to be reported to the 2015 legislature at the next Senate Bill 21 meeting, which will take place in January, receive feedback on all of that, and then we'll begin the process to finalize it and report back more formally. So that's my update, and I welcome questions.
Great.
No questions, comments. I did attend two of the community meetings, and I think you're probably right on the issues spread far beyond your shop and what we need to deal with. But I just want to say that as Senator Mona Sanderson and I have been talking about this, basically what we've done is lay a groundwork for dealing with issues that we'll be dealing with probably for the next decade. But this was a good starting point, I think, and so I'm looking forward to the report, and we will continue to have these discussions. So, I mean, this is important work. There's no question.
I agree. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate it.
All right. With that, we are going to have an update on naloxone treatment. Paul Lewis, Seamus, and Lindsay Jenkins.
I need to get Mr. Shames on the phone.
I think there's legislation in the works. Debates in there. Okay.
This is the Parker Shames family. We're not here right now. Leave us a message and we'll call you back. Thanks. Bye.
So, do you have another number for him?
No. He just said, better myself, 541. So that's what I call him.
That was his cell. That'd be great.
Okay. Let's try. Thank you so much. Sorry. I just go with what they gave me.
Hello? Jim?
Yes.
This is Sandy from the Senate Health Care and Human Services Committee. You're on the phone now.
Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Thank you.
All right. This is Senator Lori Mona Sanderson, and who is going to start?
I'll start.
Okay.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Jenkins. I'm an analyst for the Multnomah County Health Department, and I would like to thank you all for supporting and passing legislation last year that increased access to naloxone. Senator Cruz, you were one of the chief sponsors of this bill with Senator Bates, and Chair Mona Sanderson, you were one of the co-sponsors. Thank you. Just a quick recap, naloxone is a safe medication that reverses opiate overdose. It has traditionally been used only by paramedics and clinicians and ERs and hospitals. This law made it so that lay people could get trained to use naloxone and carry it to save someone's life if they were overdosing. So the bill was signed into law of June 2013. A month later, the Oregon Health Authority put into effect temporary rules for the bill, for the law. That same day, our community partner in downtown Portland, Outside In, started training their syringe exchange clients to carry naloxone. Earlier this year, my program at Multnomah County Health Department also started training our clients to carry naloxone, and together our two agencies have trained over 1,400 people to carry naloxone. The training takes about 10 minutes. At the end of the training, they get a kit that looks like this. It's got two doses of naloxone in it. In the 17 months we've been doing this work, our trainees have reported reversing 554 overdoses. In the first year that we started doing this, the number of heroin deaths in Multnomah County dropped by 29%. We can't take credit for that entirely. The number of deaths fluctuates from year to year already, and you really need to see several years of decreasing deaths to draw any conclusions. So it is a little early, but we do believe that naloxone contributed to this decrease in deaths. So again, we thank you. This law was crucial in making that happen. And I'd just like to share with you some, not only are we grateful, but our clients are profoundly grateful to have the opportunity to carry naloxone, as are their friends and family and loved ones. So I want to read to you a few quotes and comments that we have written down when they report using their naloxone. So first one, this saved the most important person in my life. Mm-hmm. Today could have been so much different than it is. Next one is, she would have died. We were in our camp, which is about a quarter mile from the closest road. Our camp is quite hidden, so there's no way an ambulance could have gotten to us. Next one, the idea of a stranger dying in my house was terrifying. I never thought I would need naloxone, and then I used it on two different people in one night. And these two are more comments the staff wrote down. Client reported that he was in St. Helens, and it took the ambulance 29 minutes from the time they called till they arrived. He wanted us to know that this person would have died without naloxone. And finally, client had to use naloxone on his mother. He felt it took a long time to take effect. He was scared and shaking. So Outside In has also trained several parents, 20 to 30 parents, who have a child who is either already overdosed or is at risk for overdose and who want to be prepared. We currently offer training at 5 sites in Multnomah County and 1 in Clackamas County. We created a training video. It's up on YouTube. Any agency in Oregon can use this video if they want to train people and have the manpower to do it. And we have gotten requests from around the state already, from places like Hood River, Corvallis, Eugene, and Jackson County, places where people want to start doing this work. And our next speaker is going to tell you a little bit more about that in Jackson County.
Thank you.
That's actually Dr. Seamus.
Yeah, hi. So this is Jim Shanks. I'm the medical director for Jackson County.
Dr. Shames, you're fading out really bad. We can't hear you.
Oh, boy. Okay, I'll talk louder. I'm not sure if that'll solve the problem.
No, that's great.
Can you hear me okay now?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm the medical director for Jackson County Health and Human Services, and we average about 30 accidental overdoses a year. Now, in the beginning, those were primarily prescription painkillers. We've been working very aggressively to correct that problem. We have a lot of strategies involved, and we've seen that number go down. However, the number of heroin overdoses has been increasing concomitantly. So we have a number of strategies to try and protect the public, and one of which is the use of naloxone. Now, we're quite rural. Certainly parts of Jackson County are quite rural. And when 911 is called, law enforcement is often the first one to respond. And in some parts of the county, the lag time between when the sheriff shows up or the police show up and when the emergency services show up can be many minutes. So one of the strategies that we've employed is to get naloxone into the hands of law enforcement. And in fact, we're the first law enforcement entity in the state to carry naloxone. Medford Police Department has naloxone in all of its vehicles. We've trained the officers. We've gotten the medication into their hands, and I'm sure that this is going to be a life-saving strategy. The issue is that we know that users are hesitant to call 911 because they're afraid they're going to get arrested, and that there have been delays. People do very inappropriate things to avoid having the police show up when someone they're with has overdosed. And some of those delays have resulted in deaths. So we really would like a Good Samaritan provision that will let folks be more comfortable to know that they're not going to be arrested for simple possession or a parole or probation violation. They can call with impunity. They don't have to leave the scene. They don't have to do inappropriate heroics. They can call. They can get law enforcement to show up, and they can get life-saving naloxone. We have every reason to believe that all of the law enforcement entities, Jackson County, Sheriff, and the other police departments, will be joining us shortly. So this is an important provision, important part of our county strategy, and I think a Good Samaritan provision will really help us in that regard.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks, Chair Mona Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Paul Lewis. I'm the public health officer for Multnomah County. And I want to, again, thank you for the provision of the naloxone law and, of course, to the community partners that have made it possible and led to this dramatic reduction in accidental deaths, often of young people with many potentially good years in front of them. Dr. Shames mentioned the importance of 911 in this. It's important for two reasons. Number one, despite the thousands of people trained, not everyone who witnesses an overdose is going to have either been trained or have the naloxone on hand. The other is even those that do have it, I guess Dr. Shames mentioned, may have a concern about getting themselves in trouble and then have a conflict between performing or getting the life-saving things there and getting themselves in trouble. The other medical fact about naloxone, it's a dramatic drug, wakes people up. Lazarus is one of the groups that on the East Coast that calls themselves. But the thing is, even though it's very dramatic, it's very short-lived. It lasts 10 to 15 minutes, whereas the drugs on board might last much longer. You could wake up and then fall back into a comatose state again. So it's really important to get that ongoing care. And our colleagues in the recovery world tell us, actually, often it's events like this can lead people to taking those first steps toward getting into long-term recovery. As Dr. Shames mentioned, in Jackson County and elsewhere, often law enforcement arrives early or even at the same time, and survey results both from Seattle and here in our needle exchange groups demonstrate that people do have that concern and might not call if they thought they were going to get into trouble for things related to that thing. There are some good examples from around the country. 23 states plus D.C. Have Good Samaritan laws. And in fact, this body passed an analogous thing for drinking recently, in that you wouldn't get in trouble for possession of alcohol, underage, et cetera, if you were calling to try to take care of someone who was ill. This is supported at the national level by the U.S. National Drug Control Policy Office and the U.S. Conference of Mayors. So we hope that you will give this favorable consideration when it comes forward.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have already had a conversation with Senator Bates. This was our baby last time, and I think the good Samaritan provision makes total sense to me. And so I can't imagine where we're going to have a lot of trouble getting that through. So look forward during the Legislative Assembly close to you. So it's not something we pre-session file, but Madam Chair, it will be probably assigned to your committee. I think we could probably get it in, couldn't we?
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you, Dr. Shames.
Oh, thank you.
All right. With that, we'll move on to the presentation on hospital staff nursing, Susan King and Virginia Smith.
It does make total sense, you know, the good side of that. Yeah. Plus, short term, it makes me wonder what the hell they're doing. So.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association and maintain a clinical practice in a large Portland area emergency department. Some of you are familiar with previous iterations of the staffing law. Senator Knopp, in particular, who worked with us in 2001 when we enacted the first law. What I'd like to do today is just give you the brief background to advise you some of the areas that we are looking at to strengthen the existing law. In 2001, as I said, we enacted the first Oregon nurse staffing law related to hospitals. And at that time, and we continue to support a collaborative approach between the direct care staff and the administrative nursing staff within a facility. Our current law defines the process to determine staffing, and the proposal we're going to be bringing to you in this session beginning in January is really intended to strengthen the existing law and the existing framework of our law. In terms of what is existing, each hospital in the state of Oregon, licensed hospital in the state of Oregon, must have a staffing committee that is comprised of 50% direct care registered nurses and 50% nursing administration or nursing management staff. The committee is charged with developing the staffing plan, which effectively sets the matrix or the ratios for each nursing unit in the hospital. The committee is expected to develop that plan based on the needs of the patients, the skill mix of the staff, and existing national specialty standards where they exist, and to implement that plan. It's important to note with this approach that there isn't a one-size-fits-all, as you might have heard about from other states, because we continue to believe that the experts in staffing any particular facility are those practicing nurses within that facility, and we want to make sure that you understand that that is still our belief, that the best way to staff hospital is to rely on the experts within. The division within the Oregon Health Authority, which now is called the Healthcare Regulation and Quality Improvement, is the agency which investigates complaints when they exist and also conducts the random audits that were first implemented in 2001 or after the 2001 legislature. We've now had 10 years of experience with this law, slightly over 10 years of experience with the law, and we are convinced that it is time for us to make some improvements. We'll be bringing a proposal, as I said, that'll be based on a two-year review of the processes and some of the problems that have existed with the existing law and have been reviewed and proposed by a stakeholder group, a wide stakeholder group of nurses across the state. There is a great deal of national data that was beginning in the late 90s and in 2001 when we enacted the first legislation, and that data has become much more clear about the relationship between adequacy of nurse staffing and patient outcomes and the safety of care. However, what we are finding is that despite compelling data and the existing law, we still are encountering problems. We recently conducted a survey of our membership. Only 19% said that staffing was consistently adequate, and only 40% reported that staffing in their facility has gotten worse over the last 5 years. Our direct care staff and members around Oregon are increasingly reporting incidents of inadequate staffing in their facilities. In over 80% of the instances in which staffing was insufficient, reports occur that staff that care is either delayed or omitted. That could be things like pain management for patients experiencing severe pain or those kinds of nursing interventions. You'll hear more in a minute from Virginia Smith about enforcement of the law. However, despite 10 years of audits, there remain hospitals that have never been audited or nurse staffing, and in the past several years, we've noted that there are a number of complaints that have taken months or even months to begin the investigation. I would say that complaints are not frequent. It is our belief that the best way to resolve staffing problems is to resolve them internally. However, what we are finding is when the last resort and a staffing last resort is considered and a staffing complaint is made, the agency's response time is very slow. As I've stated, our proposal is intended to build on the existing law. What we do is in the proposal, what we will do in the proposal is clarify that the plan developed and approved by the staffing committee is final and shall be implemented by the hospital. That is one of the biggest areas of problems that we are encountering. The staffing committee may well approve a plan, but subsequently that plan is either not implemented because of budgetary concerns or it's ignored. And that is something that we believe needs to be strengthened within the new law. It enhances the functionality of the committee. Another area that we are encountering difficulties is that the direct care staff has to be released from their patient care assignment if they are on duty for that day, and that is not consistently happening. So we want to make sure that the committees have the opportunity to do their best work by making sure that all of the committee members are able to be present. The proposal that you'll see also builds on the transparency and accountability through posting of information about staffing, allowing observers in the staffing committee, and setting up a state-level advisory board to oversee the state enforcement and make recommendations to the state, all designed to increase the public awareness and knowledge about staffing. Secondarily, it strengthens the enforcement that the agency is to conduct. That is a very quick tour of what we are going to be proposing. I'd like to turn the microphone over to my colleague, Virginia Smith, and we're both happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thanks.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Chair Simonis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, for having me here today. My name is Virginia Smith. I'm a registered nurse. I work in a medium-sized community hospital in the Portland metro area, and I've worked there for 6 years. I'm also the co-chair of our staffing committee at our hospital. I have been for the last several years, and I've served on the committee since its inception in 2010. Just a little history about the staffing committee at my hospital. We were actually cited by the state for not having one until 2010, and so then we quickly formed one, and we've been developing it since then, and its identity and task in the hospital has been continuing to develop since 2010. One of the biggest challenges is that it does not function as the decision-making group for staffing within the hospital. Decisions for staffing are largely made by administration, budgetary committees, and productivity committees through the finance department for the regional system that my hospital belongs to. And then decisions are made and then basically passed by the staffing committee within my hospital as a FYI. The committee largely functions as a formality to conform with the state law. As I've learned and my colleagues on the committee have learned to look at the law and try to get the committee to be compliant with the stipulations of the current law, it's basically only through strong encouragement from the floor staff to ask our administrators to let the staffing committee be the decision-making group for the hospital. The challenge that we experienced last year, as an example of how the committee hasn't really functioned that well, decisions were made in our emergency department to downsize staff. These decisions were passed by the staffing committee. We objected, it was noted in our minutes,
the decision went forward, and we continued to lose staff. And by December of 2013, the emergency department was so short-staffed that there were some nights where there were only two nurses on from midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning on a day-to-day basis. At the same time, my hospital had opened up a behavioral health unit, which brought a tremendous amount of psychiatric patients to our hospital that, because of the poor staffing, we were unable to meet the needs of those patients. At that time, we filed a complaint with the state, myself and several staffing committee members. That complaint has yet to be followed up on, and there's been no investigation, and no one has come to talk to us. It's actually in my hospital's policy that we would call upon the state to come and help us if the committee were ever at an impasse about staffing decisions. And again, there has been no one from the state. We called in March of this year and June of this year as well to ask when we were going to have someone visit us, and we have been told we can wait.
So who in the Oregon Health Authority is responsible for follow-up of a complaint like that?
It's my understanding that it's the
healthcare regulation and quality improvement is within the public health division.
Okay. Thank you.
So given those challenges, I mean, we've, Sally Forth and RED has now been able to hire staff. However, the problems still exist, given that the staff that they have hired are new and still training, and we're just now a year later getting ourselves sort of out of the dire straits that we were in. The med-surg unit that I work on, we were also short-staffed. I've got patient stories that I could share with you where long wait times. We had a woman in our ED lobby who waited for 6 hours, was triaged, taken back to diagnostic imaging, returned back to the lobby because there was not enough staff to take her back to an ED bed, and then wheeled to the OR for surgery without ever having actually been in their emergency department, and then admitted to the hospital after that. We were short-staffed up on med-surg and had a scheduled hysterectomy patient who, when she came out of surgery and wasn't able to be admitted to our department, we did have a bed for her in our labor and delivery unit, and she begged the staff not to be admitted there because she'd had a fetal demise there, and we admitted her there anyways. And this, basically constitutes a hardship for our nurses to have to care for our patients in this way, and it's also a hardship on the community to know that the staff at our hospital are overworked or not. There's just simply not enough of them to take care of them. So given that patients are my priority and my community is my priority, as well as my staff that I work with, we do acknowledge that our administrators are under a tremendous amount of pressure to stay solvent and run a hospital. Is our shared goal to take care of our patients, but when the decision making for staffing our hospital is challenging for them to make the right decision with the pressures that they have financially, it makes it hard for the floor nurses to then remind them that there's a law that we also have to follow. So having better oversight from the state to help our administrators be more compliant with the law, as well as empowerment for our staffing committees to be the decision-making groups for our hospitals, is something that the reforms to the current nurse staffing law would be in the right direction for providing the best kind of care for our patients and our communities.
Thank you so much. I really wanted the committee to have sort of a preliminary, because we're going to hear a lot more about this in the 2015
session. Very important
issue. Okay.
All right.
Thank you so very much for coming. With that, we'll go into the Oral Health Strategic Plan for Oregon. Melissa Freeman.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Melissa Freeman. I work for the Oregon Community Foundation, and I'm here on behalf of the Oral Health Funders Collaborative, which represents about 12 different philanthropic organizations in the state, including Kaiser Permanente, Providence Health and Services, Cambia Health Foundation, Meyer Memorial Trust, and several others. And as you recall, or may recall, I was here in May to talk to you about the emergency department study that we commissioned on the use of emergency departments for dental pain, and also to share with you that the collaborative in partnership with the Oregon Oral Health Coalition and the Oregon Health Authority had been working for 18 months to put together a strategic plan for oral health in Oregon. And so today I'm here to just share the plan with you. I've distributed copies, and I hope you can get a chance to look at these. I would like to orient you to the plan just briefly, if that's all right. The last plan that was produced was in 2006, and this plan is now taking us forward from 2014 through 2020. We've had over 30 organizations endorse it, including the governor. And I just wanted to point out a few features about the plan.
I have one or two.
We broke it up into three different focus areas: workforce capacity, infrastructure, and prevention and systems of care. We have icons noting where different groups can get involved. And as you'll see in the plan, we've made it very easy for people who are funders or elected officials or community advocates or nonprofits to identify where they might be able to make a difference and help to achieve these goals. All of the work is it's really been produced by a collaborative effort, and we're very excited about the collective vision that those from the Oregon Dental Association, as well as OHA, and everyone in between came to agreement about where we need to go. The first priority, obviously, is the dental director. And we're really hopeful that we get that position filled very soon. We've heard that they're in the process of interviewing candidates and hope that they will be able to attract someone who has a public health mindset as well as dental experience. And of course, what goes along with that position of authority is having a budget to actually implement this plan. Specifically for infrastructure, it'll be really important to have a comprehensive surveillance system where we can really track all the activity that's going on around the state. Philanthropic dollars are paying largely for the dental services, and if we can get a better sense of what's actually happening statewide, it would really improve our efforts. So today, you know, we're really hoping that you might consider in the session putting that position into statute in order to make sure that this position is part of our structure, that's part of our governance structure for dental care in Oregon, and that, you know, we understand that budget cuts may come up and it may not always be funded, but that at least legislative representatives have to take a second look before eliminating that position again. We'd really like to not have to be back here every year trying to make sure that that position is funded. I encourage you to take a look at the plan. We have several copies for you available. It is actually pretty reader-friendly and, again, represents a lot of work with some specific outcome measures and things that we can do within the next 6 years to improve oral health conditions for all ages, not just children. We looked at the entire lifespan here. Another just idea for you to consider, because I am comfortable in thinking that you have been hearing about this dental crisis and that you care about it. One other piece to consider as we go through the CCO transformation is dental care organizations want to help. They want to get involved. And one way to help them from the state's level is to have a county coordinator that's working on dental issues. One of the best models that we've seen implemented in the state is when a county dental coordinator connects the services of the dental care organization with a school or a community-based organization. And without that person making those connections, it doesn't have to be a dental professional, but without that person to make those connections and make the program run efficiently, things tend to take a lot more time and they don't happen. So just as an example, OCF right now is gearing up to invest over $2 million with a couple of other partners in creating a coordinated model to work with the CCOs and the DCOs, the schools, and when we put out a request for proposals, there was over $5 million in demand across the state just from those who responded with a proposal to put coordinators in place and to get these programs up and running. So the demand is large. The need is really for that coordination to happen on the ground to get kids, especially the basic prevention and education services they need. With that, you know, I'll stop. I appreciate a few minutes of your time today. I know you have a busy schedule, but please look to us as champions in this field and partners in your work as you try to improve oral health across the state.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I, of course, have always been interested in the workforce piece and expanding the oral health team, and I'm excited about what the state is doing with the dental hygienist expansion of that. I met with the dean at the dental school Friday, last week, and quite impressive now that they are in their new building on the Willamette. They are state of the art, and it was very encouraging to talk with the dean, because I'd heard he was very conservative, but he's very open to expanding the dental health team with a model that will reach out to those patients or those the population that's not getting the oral health care that they need, especially right. Our kids, right. Our very young kids and those in our school system. So I'm really excited about this plan and about now finally getting some real push into taking care of oral health. So thank you so much.
Right. Madam Chair, I do have a bill on that dental director.
Yeah, I'm more interested in getting to the grassroots, but yeah, dental director is extremely important
just
to have.
It gives us an opportunity to get some grants.
Grant monies, exactly.
It's
and there are some
policy.
Philanthropic nonprofits. Northwest Health Foundation has taken an interest. The Pew Foundation has taken an interest, so I'm quite excited.
There's just one follow-up to your Senate Bill 738, mm-hmm. and several funders have come together to pay for a planning grant for OHSU to put together pilot projects before that bill sunsets. So we're all funding that planning process and hope to see it in the next year or so about how we could roll these workforce pilots out.
That's great. And you know, they just started that just this last summer, and this was passed in 2011.
Right.
But we may have to just remove the sunset, because I think these pilot projects will be super important.
Yeah, we're excited about it.
So. Okay.
Thank you for your leadership.
You bet. All right. No further questions. We'll now move to the health effect of microwave radio frequency, Dr. Martin Paul and Dr. Paul Dart.
Thank you very much, Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, for scheduling this. We have a lot to talk about, And I'm going to try to be very brief because I know Dr. Dart has a lot of important things to present. So we're both going to have a substantial presentation. Let's see. Okay. My title basically is that these microwave electromagnetic fields and, in fact, other lower frequency electromagnetic fields do not work by heating, as has been argued over and over and over again, and they produce effects through VGCC activation, and that won't tell you anything, but hopefully it'll tell you something in a moment. So, let's see. Let me just say a little bit about who I am. I have a bachelor's degree in physics. I took a lot of chemistry and biology. I have a PhD in biochemistry and genetics from Caltech, one of the top institutions in the world. I retired as professor emeritus of biochemistry and basic medical sciences at Washington State University. I'm a Portland resident. I received seven international honors for my work in environmental medicine having to do with chemical exposures, and more recently have gotten interested in electromagnetic fields. The first paper that I published, which was published last year, was honored by inclusion at the Global Medical Discovery Site as one of the top medical publications of 2013. I've got two other papers that have been published, and I've got a third that's been submitted. And I've been giving a lot of professional talks in various countries, mostly in Europe and in the U.S. So the international ICNIRP and U.S. safety standards for microwave radiation don't directly apply to devices that fall within the control of the state of Oregon, but because they've often been used to claim safety for state-controlled devices, they're relevant in that way. These safety standards are based entirely on the assumption that the only important thing that microwave EMFs can do is to heat things. Like heating your food in a microwave oven. They assume, therefore, that if heating is minimal, we don't need to worry about health effects. And we know that that assumption is false, and therefore that there's no basis for the safety standards. How do we know that? We know that, first of all, because there are thousands of papers in the scientific literature showing biological effects where there should be none according to the safety standards. These individually, then, serve to falsify the current safety standards. Secondly, pulse fields are more biologically active than non-pulse fields, and that's also inconsistent with heating because these are measured at the same heating levels, and yet they have much bigger biological effects. We also know that what the actual main mechanism is, and that's going to be the focus of my talk. So, there are now 26 studies. 24 were in my publication. There are two others, subsequent studies, that have shown that biological effects produced by low-intensity EMFs can be blocked by what are known as calcium channel blockers. These are drugs that block what are known as voltage-gated calcium channels, and those are abbreviated VGCCs. And what each of those studies shows, then, is that the EMFs are working through the activation of these channels, not by heating. Okay. And these include effects produced by extremely low-frequency EMFs, such as the EMFs coming from our wiring. They include further studies that show, and there are close to 1,000 of these studies that show that microwave exposures influence calcium fluxes and calcium signaling. So these are effects that are produced by the VGCCs, and I'll tell you in a minute how they're produced by it. The other thing that's important about the VGCC mechanism was that it was predicted by two biophysical modeling studies that were published by Panagopoulos and his colleagues in Greece. And so they predicted it, and basically what my first paper did was to confirm their prediction. I did not know about their prediction when I published the paper. So I was doing it sort of blind, but that's in fact what the publication showed. So how then do these things work? So first of all, what are VGCCs? They're channels in the plasma membrane, in the outer membrane of cells. And as I think you know, all cells are surrounded by an outer membrane. And the VGCCs are in that membrane. And when they're activated, they open up and they allow calcium to flow into the cell. And it's the excess calcium in the cell which is responsible for most of the biological effects. Okay? So we're looking at calcium effects. And then what does calcium do subsequently? And that's what's shown on this slide. And so you can see that the VGCCs then increase intracellular calcium. That's what this shows. That's what this indicates. One of the things that calcium does in the cell is it increases the level of nitric oxide, NO. Why does it do that? Because two of the enzymes that produce nitric oxide are calcium dependent. So they need a lot of calcium in order to work. And they only get that then when you've got a lot of calcium in the cell. And nitric oxide does then a couple of things. One is it triggers a signaling pathway over here. And we think, and I'll tell you a little bit about that, we think that therapy is produced by that. So there are therapeutic effects of these fields, and they are now known to go through this pathway. Okay. Nitric oxide can also react with superoxide to form peroxynitrite, which is a potent oxidant. And peroxynitrite can break down to form free radicals, produce oxidative and nitrosative stress. And all of these things are thought to contribute to various kinds of pathophysiological effects. You can also get pathophysiological effects by having excessive calcium producing excessive calcium signaling. So calcium has other signaling effects that do occur independent of nitric oxide, and they can also be involved. And so we have, I think, a fairly detailed idea of how this fits in to the physiology of the organism and how then it can produce both therapeutic effects and pathophysiological, that is, damaging effects. Okay? So I have a list in this table of various effects. These have been reported repeatedly in the literature as occurring in response to low-level microwave fields. Okay? Some of these are animal studies, some of these are human studies, some of these are studies in cell culture. And so we know it produces oxidative stress. And what this table shows, and this is, and I don't really have time to talk about this, is that the apparent mechanisms are all things that that come out of that previous slide. Okay, so they're all things that we think are caused either the pathophysiological effects or, in the case of therapy, the therapeutic effects. And so basically, every single one of these apparent mechanisms are consistent with that figure that I just showed you. Okay, so we don't have time to talk about these, but basically what is true is that oxidative stress producing single-strand and double-strand breaks in cellular DNA. And let me say, this is important because it's the DNA in the cells that are being broken. It's not DNA that's isolated in a test tube. That can occur through free radical attacks. Cancer can be caused by these set of mechanisms. And let me just say, we know that these sort of mechanisms are involved in what is known as inflammatory carcinogenesis. That is, when you have an inflamed tissue, cancer tends to develop much more frequently in those tissues. So we know cancer can be caused in this way, and these are all, again, what are called downstream effects of excessive intracellular calcium. We can get a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, by known mechanisms. Male and female infertility, other things, again, that have been reported repeatedly as being effects produced by these fields. And therapeutic effects, I already mentioned. There are diverse neuropsychiatric effects, including depression, but also including many other things. Melatonin depletion and sleep disruption is another thing that's been repeatedly found. Cataract formation occurs through VGCC activation and increase in intracellular calcium. Let me just say that it has been claimed repeatedly that cataract formation is caused by heating. In fact, when I went through that literature in this paper that was submitted, I think I gave the committee a copy of that, it's very clear that that's not true, okay? That calcium, excess intracellular calcium, has an essential role in cataract formation. And so the cataract formation is probably through this mechanism, not through heating. There are cardiac effects, tachycardia, arrhythmia, sometimes leading to sudden cardiac death. We're having epidemics of these, unexplained epidemics, increased, and we can understand how those can occur as well. So, now these are not the only things that may be caused by EMFs. We know that VGCCs have a role in Alzheimer's disease. There are studies, two studies that have reported occupational exposures to extremely low frequency. So these are like the fields that come out of our wiring rather than microwaves. But they, as I mentioned before, act in the same way. They act by VGCC activation. And they appear to cause Alzheimer's disease. What's perhaps more relevant here is that there was a fascinating study published last year that showed that short pulses of microwave radiation can cause apparent Alzheimer's disease in rats. And so that is extremely important and very worrying. Rare mutation, okay, so in addition, there's arguments for autism. There have been an argument that's been published by eight different research groups arguing that autism may be caused by microwave EMFs. I think the critical piece of evidence may be that we know that rare mutations in one of the VGCC genes, it produces excessive activity of the channels, okay, can cause autism. So autism can be caused by this, by microwave increases in VGCC activation. We don't know that that is the cause in the general population, okay, but it is a possibility that one has to be concerned about. And so, as I think you know, there's been this catastrophic increase in autism, which is at least roughly parallel to the increase in microwave exposures in the population. In conclusion, low-intensity EMFs act by activating VGCCs, not by heating. Safety standards are entirely based on heating effects and are therefore without any scientific basis. Many apparent health consequences are probable consequences of what are called downstream effects of VGCC activation. And those health effects include cancer, DNA damage, infertility, diverse neuropsychiatric effects, and possibly autism and Alzheimer's disease. Many apparent health consequences threaten the four things that we most value as individuals and as a species. It threatens our health, our brain function, the integrity of our genomes, and our ability to produce healthy offspring. There are many approaches to improving the safety of the many cordless communication devices that produce exposures to these fields, but there has been little or no focus in doing so. Thank you.
Yeah. I don't have my. Oh, maybe I do have my. Oh. Let's see if you can do that. Okay.
Is this presentation getting out?
Oh, not yet.
It needs to be.
Yeah.
Thank you.
this a good distance from the microphone?
That's fine.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for allowing me to give you this testimony.
And please state your name for the record.
My name is Paul Dart, M.D. I practice in Eugene, Oregon. And I grew up in Oregon, went to school in California and Washington State, and then went to medical school at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And did an internship at Oregon Health Sciences University and a fellowship in environmental medicine. I've been practicing in Eugene since 1988. Now, the FCC guidelines as Dr. Paul stated, only discuss protection of the public against thermal effects. And the FCC has explicitly stated that they make no regulations or assurances whatsoever regarding the non-thermal biological effects of microwave RF. For years, spokesmen of industry have said that not enough is known about this, more studies need to be made, there's no conclusive evidence, and you could get the impression that there isn't a lot of evidence. But actually, there's quite a bit of scientific information on the subject of clinical effects. Dr. Paul's talked about the latest science on the causes, the mechanism of this. I want to talk about the clinical aspects of this subject. And I'm going to discuss two different issues, acute symptoms, which is often called electrical hypersensitivity syndrome, and more chronic symptoms, which include issues with cancer and infertility. Now, acute symptoms from microwave radiation were described by Russian researchers in the 1950s, and the Russians actually used microwaves to harass the United States Embassy from 1953 to 1978. They transmitted from a nearby rooftop, and the U.S. Embassy hired someone from Johns Hopkins to do research epidemiologically on the results of this, which showed increases in depression, irritability, difficulty in concentration, memory loss, ear problems, skin problems, vascular problems, and other health problems in embassy staff during this period over what would be expected in the background. Exposure levels inside the building were at a level of 2 to 28 microwatts per centimeter squared. The FCC guidelines permit 600 microwatts per centimeter squared. In Lenora, Spain, a research project was done in a town of 1,900 inhabitants with a cell phone tower in the middle of the community. And they compared symptoms of various sorts. In this circle here, which was close to the tower, within 150 meters of it, with another area greater than 250 meters away from the tower. And this is what they found. Here we have the control group from farther away, the group within 150 meters, and this group had significantly more symptoms of depression, sleep disturbance, headache, poor concentration, and irritability. And every time you see a star like this on one of these bars, it means that it's statistically significant data in terms of the statistical analysis. In France, in 2002, a study was done looking at similar symptoms as compared to proximity of residents to cell phone towers. And here what we see, it stratified the data by distance from the tower, greater than 300 meters to less than 10 meters from the tower. And people who reported symptoms often and very often. And we can see that at proximity to the tower, significant numbers of people had increased irritability, also increased headaches, sleep disturbance, depression, memory loss.
Can you go back one? I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Can you go back one slide?
How many? Say
one. That one right there. Doesn't matter. Pick one.
Yeah.
Memory loss is fine.
So why do you think there's a variability? I mean, for example, less than 10 meters, it's actually less for memory loss. So you're actually seeing a diminishing effect the closer you get. Is it an umbrella effect?
Well, microwave transmission doesn't just diffuse evenly. It's a combination of frequency and rate of transmission, and the focus actually can be a little higher farther away than right next to it.
But in some of your other ones, the very often is more the closer you get.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Could I make a comment on that?
Go ahead.
Yes.
There have been a number of studies done on animals and on cells in culture, which have shown that the dose response curves are extremely complex and difficult to understand, okay? Where you can have particular levels of exposure that give higher responses than either higher levels or lower levels. So in other words, it's counterintuitive.
It's a J-curve problem.
Right. You can have situations where higher exposures actually produce less effects.
Yeah. And in my written testimony, some of these issues will be discussed in a lot more detail than I can in this brief presentation. In Egypt in 2003, a cell phone tower that had been installed in this area in 1998, they studied inhabitants living near this tower and compared them to people or control group that lived greater than 2 kilometers away. And they found a significant increased incidence of headaches, memory changes, dizziness, depression, sleep disturbance, and tremors in the group that lived near the tower. Several studies done on large numbers of young children in the Danish birth cohort evaluated the health status of children at age 7 and found in their questionnaire, one of the issues was the child exposed to cell phones in utero or after? And they found a significant increase in behavioral problems in young children that had had prenatal and postnatal exposure. And if they stratified this data out by different sorts of problems, here we see emotional issues, hyperactivity, conduct problems, peer problems. And children with prenatal and postnatal exposure to cell phones had an increase that was statistically significant in migraine headaches and in other health headache-related symptoms. Now, exposure to microwave RF has increased dramatically in the last 10 or 15 years with the role of the wireless communications industry. This is data from France. This line here is reference point of 0.1 microwatts per centimeter squared of average exposure, which many authorities in Europe would consider to be a safe limit for the public. But many common exposures now are present with us constantly. This is a meter that measures a Wi-Fi router output, and it also transliterates the sound. The frequency output of the router, that waveform, into sound. And if you could hear your Wi-Fi router, this is what it sounds like. A Wi-Fi router constantly transmits, whether or not it's being used by the computers around. It's just that's the communication protocol, steady transmission. And we're in the process now of putting this kind of steady transmission of RF into all the schools, into all of our public spaces, which has significant health implications. Now, the prevalence of self-reported electrohypersensitivity is increasing over time. These are data points from research done over the last 15 years or so. Studies in Austria show higher levels than previous. It would be a reasonable estimate that right now in the United States, perhaps somewhere between 3 and 5% of people have symptoms of this sort and know it. And there may be other people who are having insomnia from their Wi-Fi routers and don't know it. A common thing I do with patients who are having trouble sleeping is I tell them to turn off their Wi-Fi router at night. And a certain percentage of them sleep significantly better when they do so. Now, oxidative stress, which is produced by the mechanisms Dr. Paul discussed, can damage DNA. And this is an image from a very sophisticated, or should I say sensitive, study. This is a clump of DNA, and it's been caused to migrate across an electrophoretic gel with an electrical field. But the DNA is fragmented, and the fragments aren't the same size, and they don't move as quickly. So they leave a tail behind them. It looks kind of like a comet. And this assay is a very sensitive assay for DNA damage. Now, here's a measure of DNA fragmentation in rat brains produced by 0.34 microwatts per centimeter squared 2 hours a day for 35 days. Remember, the FCC guidelines for thermal exposure are 600 microwatts per centimeter squared. And we see that the tail is longer. The head is longer. Everything's spread out more because there's more damage and fragmentation in the DNA in the rat brains. This is exposure at a similar level of exposure, 2 hours per day for 35 days, showing a decrease in two different types of antioxidants, which is evidence of oxidative stress under these circumstances. And here they measured melatonin levels in animals exposed for a similar amount of time. Melatonin is involved both in our ability to sleep, and it's also very protective against breast cancer because it's the strongest antioxidant produced in the human body. Now, what are the consequences of this kind of physiologic event in human beings with damage of DNA, disruption of melatonin? We can see significant health consequences here, and research has shown issues such as cancer and reduced fertility to be produced by these exposures. Here's a study of amateur radio operators in the state of California. They looked at the death certificates of everyone who was a member of the Amateur Radio Association and working with radios a lot as a hobby. And this is the expected mortality rate based on the population at large, and this is the actual mortality rate in this group. And they had a significantly higher level of leukemia of various types. As this is based on their death certificates. A study done in the Polish military comparing people who worked a lot with radar microwave communications compared to unexposed controls showed increased cancer of the gastrointestinal tract, brain, blood, including several types of leukemia. This was in a large cohort of Polish military personnel. The U.S. Air Force did a study comparing different exposure levels. Pilots are exposed to higher levels because they're up next to the radios in the fronts of the planes, with the odds ratio for brain tumor. And this is their exposure stratification of the level of exposure in their scoring system. Higher levels of exposure had a significantly increased odds ratio for brain tumor. In Israel, in 1996, a cell phone tower was set up down here on the beach, exposing a large community. And a study was done comparing people close to the tower in the city as a whole, an area far from the tower, and an area near the tower. And what they saw was significant increase in cancer, more so in women. A lot of this is probably breast cancer. And this is combined men and women in people living close to the tower. In Austria, a study was done on a cell tower set up in a community studying the case control of cancer patients living within 1,200 meter radius of the tower. And they measured RF levels on the outside of their houses, right next to their building. This is the stratification. This is the level of power of exposure outside the individual's building. And here we see the highest level of exposure, higher levels of all cancers, 20 times more, well, maybe 10 times more, but it's a significant increase in breast cancer and a very strong increase in brain cancer in people living closer to the tower with higher levels of exposure outside their houses. In Brazil, Belo Horizonte is the capital of Minas Gerais state in Brazil. It's population of over 2 million people in 2010. Rated in, by the UN as having a best quality of life in Latin America in 2007. And by 2006, they put 856 cell towers into the city. Researchers mapped the location of every cell tower, and they mapped from public health records the location of all individuals in the city that have died of cancer between 1996 and 2006. And they calculated the distance between the dead person's residence and the closest cell phone tower. And this is what they found. The closer to the tower, the higher the rate of mortality of cancer. And at distances higher than, closer than 500 meters, this was statistically significant difference.
Are we close to the end?
I've got two more issues to discuss, so I could probably talk for another 8 minutes, but I can speed it up.
Yeah, speed it up.
Okay. Sperm concentrations have been going down since for many years, and there is some research that cellular transmissions from phones can decrease sperm motility. Here, exposed for 5 minutes, sperm in vitro with less motile sperm. This is a study of cell phone users, and people that used the phone more than 4 hours a day had the largest decrease in sperm count, motility, viability, and normal morphology. Here's another example of that data. And here's a study with laptop Wi-Fi. They put sperm laptop distance from a laptop computer, lap distance from it, and they found significant decreases in sperm motility after 4 hours of exposure. Now, we've been told over and over that cell phones don't have a significant risk of cancer. This is one of the studies that quoted as saying that cell phones don't cause cancer. They said there wasn't a trend, but in their highest tenth of their data set, there was a significant increase in cancer rate with people who'd used a phone for over 640 hours. And if they'd used it in less than 4 years, they'd accumulated that. They had four times the risk of brain tumors. Here's risk of glioma. And it's more common on the same side. This is from the study that's quoted as saying that cell phones don't cause increased risk of cancer in their conclusions, but this is their actual data. The study was funded by the industry. And the Hardell group in Sweden have done several studies over the last 10 years showing increased risk of glioma, astrocytoma, all tumor types, more common on the same side as the phone, and more common with accumulated greater use, and more common if the person starts using a cell phone before age 20. A study published this spring in France showed similar data, significantly increased risk of glioma if people used a phone more than 15 hours a month, more than 896 hours total use, more than this number of calls. And this would be four times the risk of the control group. And that is the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Obviously, you have a lot of data there.
Yeah.
And we are in a culture that relies totally on now our how we're all communicating.
Yeah.
And doing all our work on this. And I'm hoping that there will be research on how we can cut down exposures. And just the one comment that you said is, you know, turning off your router at night, et cetera, because people are not going to give up their microwaves and they're not going to give up their cell phones and computers. So I'm hoping that we come along with ideas on how to reduce the risks for pregnant women, for, you know, our young kids, et cetera. But I want to thank you for your presentation. Any other comments?
I think this is going to be interesting to see a lot more data. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
we aren't studying it here in the United States.
No, there's been great resistance on the part of the industry to acknowledge
for
it,
various
the issue.
Reasons.
And until you acknowledge the
economic
issue, it's hard
reasons.
To study what to do about it.
Yes, exactly. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We need an update from our telehealth work group, Bob Dubey, Mark Lovegren, Doug Romer, and Jessica Adamson.
Here, this is Doug.
Doug, this is Sandy with the Senate Health Care and Human Services Committee.
Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Doug. The panel's coming up, and the senator will start the discussion here in a minute.
Will you start off, Bob?
Oh.
Bob?
It's Doug.
Is it Doug?
Doug's on the phone, Bob.
But, Bob, are you going to start? Or
yeah,
it's
I can
Doug?
Start off, Bob.
Yeah, okay.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Bob Dimmig. I'm the Deputy Director of the Office of Rural Health and a member of the board for the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. And I'm here today in support of the introduction of LC-918 as a committee bill. During the 2014 legislative session, this committee and Senator Mona Sanderson asked TAO to facilitate a work group to create a legislative concept expanding telemedicine reimbursement. The work group consisted of payers, providers, healthcare associations, and state agencies working over a seven-month period. The group engaged in education on the provider practice guidelines and security and privacy requirements required for the services being considered. Additionally, information and demonstrations were also provided about the services offered in other states and specifically organizations in Oregon currently offering these types of services. LC-918 expands the requirement for health benefit plan coverage of telemedicine health services, requiring them to provide coverage of telehealth services offered directly from a provider to a patient regardless of where they are. All benefit plans are as defined in ORS 743, 730, and self-insured plans would be affected by this. The type of transmission required in order to be eligible for payment of a health service must be synchronous two-way interactive video conferencing. A health benefit plan must provide coverage of a health service delivered telemedically if the plan covers the health service when provided in person. The health service is medically necessary. The health service is determined to be safely and effectively provided by using two-way interactive video conferencing. And the application and technology used to provide the health service must meet all standards required by the state and federal laws. And a payer is a payer required to pay for a service that is not included in a health plan or a provider who has not contracted with them? No. They are only required to reimburse for those services that are in their plan. And the rate of payment is determined by the contract between the payers and the providers. Our proposal for the effective date is 1/1/16, requiring that the legislation contain an emergency clause. And Jessica will touch on that here in a minute. And I would just like to thank Senator Mona Sanderson and others for their support over the last 7 months.
Thank you, Doug.
Good morning. My name is Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services. We were pleased to participate in this work group as both an insurer and a provider group and appreciated the great process that ensued. One issue with LC-918, as it appears before you, is that the implementation date does not reflect the agreement within the work group. We believe that this was a simple drafting issue. And it's something that everyone's committed to fix coming into session. The effective date, as Bob indicated, will be 1/1/16. So for all plans issued on or after that date, this new reimbursement mandate would apply. For us, the major issues included ensuring that technology used for telemedicine was compatible with federal and state privacy laws, and that the rates were negotiated between the payer and the provider. This bill provides that. It was a really great process, and we're pleased to be here to support this bill.
Morning. My name is Mark Lufgren. I'm the director of the telehealth program at OHSU. First, I'd like to thank you, Senator Moines Anderson, for putting together the work group. And I'd also like to thank Ms. Kathy Britton from the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon for chairing this important committee. I believe the work group was effective in reaching consensus on a comprehensive bill that will facilitate a significant leap forward in the delivery of healthcare services via telemedicine. Telehealth plays an important role today in helping to improve access to care, improve outcomes, and reduce healthcare expenditures, in essence, helping to meet the triple aim. While Senate Bill 24 was a great leap forward in 2010 for mandating in-home telemedicine encounters, it didn't quite go far enough. As the director of telehealth services at OHSU, I believe encouraging providers to offer in-home services where safe and secure will be a positive move for the acceptance of telemedicine. As a tertiary and quaternary care healthcare system, OHSU cares for Oregonians from every county, health district, and community in Oregon. Often patients are burdened by having to travel for follow-up care, including the need to leave their own homes when doing so might be problematic. Reimbursement for in-home encounters will take one barrier out of the way to providing care to our patients anytime, any place, and anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you. And on the phone.
Senator Moines Anderson, Senator Cruz, and committee. My name is Doug Romer. I'm the Chief Nursing Officer at Grand Ronde Hospital in La Grande, Oregon. I'm a member of the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon Board and a member of the LC918 Work Group. I've also been working with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, OAHHS, Public Policy Committee. The work group process has been beneficial in developing consensus for this legislation. The OAHHS Public Policy Committee has endorsed this concept, and the acute care hospitals in Oregon also support this effort, as long as there are no substantive changes. This will help move patient care beyond the four walls of hospitals and clinics and will be an enabling force in healthcare reform. Telemedicine reimbursement is essential to Oregon's success with healthcare transformation and assisting with provider shortages. I encourage you to accept this collaborative legislative concept and to move it forward, and thank you for your support and leadership.
Great. Thank you. I'm quite impressed with what Kathy and Bob were able to do with this committee. When we had our first draft, and then I would follow all of the changes that everybody wanted. I mean, there were just emails after emails, and it, you came out with a product, and I'm quite impressed. So, yeah.
Really quickly, Madam Chair, if I may, I had the privilege recently of being appointed co-chair of a national task force through the National Conference on State Legislatures on telehealth, and I will be contacting you all for copies of anything you can give me. The first meeting of that group is this Friday, unfortunately, in D.C., and I can't be there because of this. But I would very much like to be able to provide the task force with those materials. So if one or more of you could start emailing me stuff, I would be grateful. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I will share those.
Well, Kathy Britton and Sandy, probably Kathy would.
Madam Chair, members of the committee and work group members, the TAO webpage has a link of agendas, and
perfect.
I don't know if it's all the materials, but a substantial amount of materials is already up there.
Then I'll just send that to the folks at NCSL for inclusion, because I think it's going to be very informative to them to see how this committee, this task force, worked through a lot of the issues that this national task force will be doing. And I'd love to demonstrate that Oregon is a model for how to do this effectively.
Excellent.
And collaboratively, which we clearly are. So thank you all for your hard work and your willingness to share the work with others.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We will be in touch.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
All right, I'll close the informational hearing. I'm going to open a work session on introduction of committee legislative concept. Oh, wait, we forgot the Oregon Medical. Sorry.
Reopen your information.
Yeah, I got to reopen the informational. Let's call Nicole. Is it Krishna Swami?
Very good, yes.
And Kathleen Haley. Almost.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Thank you for welcoming us this morning to present Legislative Concept 642. My name is Nicole Krishnaswamy. I'm the Legislative and Policy Analyst for the Oregon Medical Board. And with me is Kathleen Haley, of course, our Executive Director, and we'll be happy to answer any questions that you have about the legislative concept. LC 642 would transition the medical board's organizational model to implement some administrative efficiencies. This would allow us to better focus on our achieving our mission of patient safety while also increasing access to quality care. Importantly, under this bill, we would maintain oversight and accountability. The budget, although adopted through rulemaking, would continue to be submitted to the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House, along with LFO. An important aspect of this bill that's different from other semi-independent agencies is that LFO would be required to submit the budget to Ways and Means. And the bill explicitly states that Ways and Means may hold a budget hearing and request amendments to the budget, the fees, or any charges. This LC would also require more frequent audits under the Secretary of State's office. But some things stay the same. The Senate would continue to confirm the governor's appointees to the board. The executive director continues to serve at the pleasure of the governor. And our staff would remain state employees and members of the union. Some advantages of the LC are that we would increase efficiency. We would save time with a shorter turnaround for our budget adoption process, and we would also save money because we would not be required to use DAS for all of our purchasing. Another benefit is that we would increase stakeholder involvement. Our licensees, professional associations, and the general public would be involved in our budget adoption process, and in turn, we would also be able to be more responsive to them. The LC requires increased transparency. As part of the rulemaking process for the budget adoption, we would email a notice to all of our licensees and be required to hold a public hearing. We would also be required to publish the budget and the agency's annual report on our website. This is another unique provision to the Oregon Medical Board. We feel that it's important to maintain transparency as we move to a semi-independent model. And all of the public meetings and records laws would continue to apply under this statute. It has been a board priority for many years to explore the possibility of transitioning to a semi-independent model. We believe that we're uniquely positioned as a small, other-funded agency, but we have the infrastructure in place to make the transition. We are a dynamic agency with a goal of continuous improvement, and we believe that this fits in well with that goal. We have done many years of research and exploring other boards' experience, and we believe that now is a good time for us to make this transition. We've been meeting with the governor's office, and we're awaiting final approval on the legislative concept, and we've been working closely with the Oregon Medical Association in the development of the language. All of our other professional associations have either already endorsed the bill or are currently reviewing it, and we expect to hear from them in the near future. Thank you.
Great.
I keep wondering, well, first of all, how many states have this model?
States vary in many different models. I don't have an exact number for you. We can look into other states.
Okay. And the other is once your model works and sees how you can save money and actually have more money for your board, is your other big boards like the Oregon Board of Nursing, et cetera, are going to follow suit? I mean, is this a model that's
kind of different?
There are currently three boards that are, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, already semi-independent since 1997. The Optometry Board, the Board of Massage Therapy, and the Physical Therapy Board have all been semi-independent.
Okay.
And the other health boards have been interested in the model.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. So we'll be hearing more about this also. Now I would like to close the informational hearing and open a work session on legislative comments.
Legislative concepts.
Yes, concepts.
Concepts, that's a better word. Oh, well, though we could do legislative comments as well. Okay.
We're going to do plenty of those coming up, Senator.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
Just for the record, these are concepts that have been submitted, and we're not going to go line by line. It does not mean that we approve of them
or disapprove
of them. We're just getting them filed as committee bills.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 918 dated 11-18-14, LC 1103 dated 10-18-14,
1028. I'm sorry, that was a typo.
1028? You're right. Okay. LC 1472, dated 10-17-14. LC 1473, dated 10-13-14. LC 1846, dated 10-29-14. LC 1871, dated 12-5-14. LC 1872, dated 10-9-14. LC 1965, dated 11-12-14. LC 1969, which was a great year, by the way, dated 12-4-14. LC 2397, dated 11-17-14. LC 2767, dated 11-19-14.
Pause.
Can we go off record for a second, Madam Chair? Is that possible?
Can you stand at ease?
Can we stand at ease for just a moment, please?
Yes. Stand at ease.
Okay, so let's stand at ease. I apologize. Thank you, Madam
okay.
Chair. I apologize.
And finally, LC 1524, dated 10-2014, be introduced as committee bills.
All right. Senator Cruz moves that all of the above bills, I don't need to go through each one.
Make sure you make me do it.
Yes, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If so, so ordered.
That's it.
We're done.
All right. Thank you, committee, so much for being here, and we look forward to convening in January or February.
February. Well, we may have
an organizational meeting in January.
We'll have an organizational meeting in January.
But we won't do a whole lot then.
Yeah.
But
all right. With that, we're adjourned.
The office is going to be on your committee.
With that, we're adjourned.